all the vowels. You try to land on every
Mr.
single
Carideo,
vowel.
Mr. Carideo, welcome to the committee, and thank you again for your patience and understanding over this committee deadline week.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, thank you for taking the time to hear me out. I'm your only guy here on this particular file, I hope. And so I'll try to answer any questions you have. My name is Tony Carideo, and I'm the chairman of the board of University Enterprise Laboratories. I am here to testify in favor of Senate File 2283, a bonding proposal to provide 50% of the funding for the construction of a 30 to 40,000 square foot addition to UEL in St. Paul, Minnesota. I am a volunteer. Our entire board is made up of volunteers, individuals and corporate and civic leaders who dedicate valuable time to this facility because they believe that entrepreneurship in this state is vitally important to Minnesota's economic health. Facilities like University Enterprise Laboratories lie at the very heart of that process. UEL is home for 21 early-stage life sciences companies, including several promising companies born in laboratories at the University of Minnesota. It is one of the state's shining examples of a public-private partnership. It is also the little engine that could, one that has survived and indeed prospered against all odds. Difficulties at first in finding tenants, and of course through one of the nation's most bruising economic downturns. Our facility, with 109,000 square feet of rentable space, is now 101% occupied. We've even rented out a portion of our maintenance facility. The more than 260 scientists, technologists, and others who pass through our doors each day are engaged in cutting-edge science and health services endeavors. They arrive at this workplace from all over the state. In addition to the Twin Cities metropolitan area, we have two people who commute from Wilmer, as well as employees from Farmington, Hugo, and Lake Elmo. One of our companies, Centurion, is owned by a Wilmer poultry farmer, and another, Selectus, is considering expansion into outstate Minnesota, where it sees the potential of buying more than 500 acres of farmland to continue its work in plant sciences. What we do at UEL is remarkable. Ativa Medical, for example, is an early-stage company developing an advanced medical diagnostic system. Kingfisher Biotech is developing and commercializing veterinary chemical reagents for species underserved in the commercial market. At one of our fastest-growing companies, Exosome Diagnostics, is focused on commercializing proprietary genetic-based diagnostics to improve the diagnosis of new cancer and more precisely monitor the efficacy of drug therapies. Any one of these companies in our facilities could become the next Medtronic or Genentech, and several are taking the first steps in that direction. Since its founding in 2005, UEL has graduated five companies. Our most recent graduate, a company called Optimec, started at our facility with three employees. It left a couple of months ago with five. It now has nine. Harlan Medical started with a handful of employees and now employs 35 and is in the process of being sold to a much larger concern. The same is true with Sagittus, which started similarly small and now employs 31. Earlier this week, you heard testimony from the chief executive officer of Twin Star Medical. That started at UEL and is now on its own in Minneapolis. UEL was launched with the help of corporations such as 3M, Ecolab, Medtronic, Allina, Xcel Energy, and the University of Minnesota and its foundation, and perhaps most important, the city of St. Paul, which under the leadership of then-Mayor Randy Kelly provided a city loan guarantee to back up a key portion of our original financing package totaling $17 million. This past January, UEL unwound a complex financing package, successfully defeasing the state's first ever Newmarket's tax credit along with bonds backed by a letter of credit from Wells Fargo. We refinanced our debt with $9.6 million in seven-year fixed-rate loan debt at 4.06% interest with U.S. Bank. That financing was backed by a City of St. Paul loan guarantee of $4 million, down from the city's original $6 million guarantee amount. From UEL's early days, when we were only 50% full and running large deficits, we are now able to project comfortable positive cash flows using conservative rental assumptions. The cash we generate will allow the facility to actually reduce the city's guarantee over the term of the loan, while at the same time establishing substantial reserves to cover future lease rollovers and a large reserve for debt service. By the end of our loan term, we anticipate that we will no longer need any city guarantee. Beyond that, we project cash flows in the second and third year of our current mortgage of about $100,000 per year, allowing UEL to continue to improve the existing facility and to provide additional shared amenities to our tenants. We pursue this strategy because we are a nonprofit. All our efforts are directed at securing a sound financial footing for our facility and at providing unique value-added services to our tenants. These services include equipment to which our tenants may not have access under separate facilities, everything ranging from multiple autoclaves for sterilizing equipment to sub-80-degree Celsius freezers for storing and preserving sensitive cultures. Just last week, we opened a tenant-requested machine shop for the construction of scientific equipment and prototypes. This sort of equipment can cost tens of thousands of dollars. Our largest autoclave, for example, costs $37,000. Unfortunately, I'm almost done, UEL has taken some lumps in the media, with the facility's critics arguing that it's not really a business incubator, because we don't give our space away to brand new startups, or that it's not an accelerator, another term of art in this milieu. Instead, they've demeaned the project as a real estate play, which to us is like calling Target Field a well-manicured lawn. We'd rather refer to our facility, which houses our business an average of only 3 years before they move on to other larger quarters, a job factory. Come visit our facility. Some of you already have. UEL is an impressive place, one that sends a clear signal to potential funders. The businesses in this space are serious. They're real. This is very important because the irony we face today is that Earl Bakken, who famously founded Medtronic in his garage, under current regulatory and national security strictures, would not be allowed to do that in this day and age. UEL, in answer to that reality and in response to the need to help very early stage companies, in 2010 created a garage, a place where brand new enterprises can set up shop using shared equipment and at minimal cost. Now UEL has the capacity to grow. We estimate that each year we turn away approximately 30,000 square feet of potential new tenants. It's important to know that based on our market studies, our type of space with the amenities and services we offer does not exist elsewhere in the Twin Cities or to any extent outstate. Why? Because what we have here is called wet lab space. It is expensive to build. Facilities with the proper chemical-resistant flooring and countertops, sophisticated chemical hoods and exhaust systems, fire protection, and other safety equipment can cost up to $330 a square foot to construct. These economics simply do not work using conventional financing alone. And in the sometimes tenuous financial status of our tenants, and the value proposition becomes essentially impossible for lenders and developers to justify to loan committees. Hence our request for state bonding to support the addition of new laboratories and nearby office space, whose rents would be within reach of these early-stage companies. As I look through the current draft of the state's bonding bill, I can't find many projects that combine both the opportunity to employ skilled craftsmen and women to construct the building, but that also result in permanent jobs. Employment opportunities that keep on giving, day in and day out, year in and year out, creating space for new ideas and a launching pad for companies that can grow and create many new jobs beyond the start they receive at our facility. I'd ask the legislature to help us to grow, and you can call UEL what you want, an incubator, a business accelerator, a jobs factory. One thing we know that we are for sure, and that's a success story. We ask the legislature to add a new chapter to that story by approving the state's portion of the funding for this addition. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any of your questions.
Thank you, Mr. Caridio. And for members who have just joined us, this is just an informational hearing on this particular bill, but I think it fits pretty well into the space we've been talking about over the last couple weeks and even just the last couple days here, incubators, startups. I wonder if you have just a quick thought on, here we are at the end of the first quarter, 2012. What's your sense on the economy and the kind of companies you work with or want to work with? Are we coming out of the recession? Are you optimistic?
I am Italian-American, and I am known for a certain level of cultural fatalism. However, I'm pretty bullish, and I'm not usually bullish. We are seeing a real uptick in demand for our facility. We are getting calls constantly. We had an executive committee board meeting today, and that demand continues. Our cash flow is actually improving over the financing that we just put in place. Our receivables are down. Our tenants are paying their rent faster than ever before. And I think there's a lot of money sitting on the sidelines, Mr. Chairman. If you've probably read in the papers that, corporations probably have something in the neighborhood of $1 trillion on their balance sheets. Medtronic has a huge venture fund that it puts to work every year, as does 3M. And so I think we are coming out of a recession. We have come through the worst with this facility, and it is still standing. And so I'm very optimistic that I really am that we're going to have an uptick in the business climate.
Sure. Senator Mattson.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. One thing I see here is that UEL is a proven thing already. I mean, you've already got all of this stuff going, and you've got a need to grow, and that's what this committee is looking at, growth and jobs. And again, I repeat that you've got a track record, and that's very means a lot to some of us. So,
Mr. Chairman, Senator Mattson, thank you. I appreciate that sentiment. One thing I would point out is that the business model for so-called incubators has changed over the years. It used to be the early stage incubators that when they first began to crop up, funded and gave homes to a lot of bleeding edge companies. Many of those incubators, if not all of them, are gone. And so what has evolved over the years is a different type of business model, one that is more like a shopping mall, where, as is the case with the UEL, we have several anchor tenants that provide baseload capacity and baseload rent for us. And then we are able to fill in around the edges with earlier stage, somewhat more risky enterprises. It's important as you think about this sort of thing, this is a one-time ask. Unlike other facilities in other states to our immediate east, we are not going to be in front of the legislature or at the University of Minnesota asking for $1 million cash infusion every year, which is what many of these facilities require. We'll build it, we'll cash flow it, we'll run it as a business. And that's the way we've been forced to operate since 2005.
Thank you again for your patience, Mr.
My pleasure.
Caridio.
Thank you, sir.
You have Senator Peterson, and in a good place to continue your message to the committee of special concern for you this year, and also Senator Metzen, I believe. So,
thank you for
thanks
your
for joining
support.
Us
I appreciate
and helping
it.
Us to kick off this afternoon's hearing.
All right, thank you.
Members, let's turn then to another Peterson bill. We're going to get tired of Senator Peterson this evening. Senate File 1993. Oh. Hey, say Senator Metzen, while...
we're happy that you're here.
Senator Metzen, do you know there's a birthday at the committee table today? Bill Bailey.
Bill Bailey? Oh, happy
He's
birthday.
Hiding. He's right here. You can work
happy,
on that later.
Happy 70th.
Mr. Chair and members, I would refer to this hearing really as my first hat trick.
Nice.
Oh, nice. Nice. You know, any hats in the audience? You can throw them at
got,
they have to be successful.
Yeah, that's right. Senator Peterson, Senate File 1993.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We have Senate File 1993 before you. Today, it's not real glamorous. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about sump pumps and a situation that we have in the building code that we think needs some attention, and which is why it is here before you today. Currently, Minnesota law defines sump pumps. These are in your single-family homes in your basement. Oftentimes, you'll have a hole in the floor that's about the size of a 5-gallon pail, and the drain tile around that foundation kind of runs into that hole, and this sump pump will pump any moisture that happens to get into that area up and out of the house and discharged in the proper manner. Well, these sump pumps and this drainage tile that these particular contractors work on are classified as plumbing, and residential basement health contractors currently, they do need a builder's license, a state contractor builder's license to perform remodeling work in the construction industry. But many of these contractors do not have the state plumber's license, and this plumber's license has generally not been required for sump pump installation and repair. And so this legislation just seeks to simply modify the code, particularly so that residential basement health contractors do not need a plumber's license to perform this simple remodeling work. So, Mr. Chair, I have an A1 amendment I think we need to offer at this point.
All right, hang on a sec there, Senator Peterson. Uh-oh. Delete everything. Hang on a sec, Senator Peterson, while we hand out the A1. Mm-hmm. Senator Peterson, to the A1.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members, what this amendment does, you'll notice down in the bottom of page 1 where the text originally, when we worked on this bill, we wanted to include sump pumps in all types of construction, and the compromise that we were able to work on with some of these contractors and industry representatives was to simply limit this change to single-family dwelling sump pumps. That was a large part of the work in the business, and not necessarily the original intent, but that's the compromise that we have come to, so that these basement health contractors would limit this type of work to single-family homes, and it would not include commercial work, essentially, was the compromise.
Well, Senator Peterson offers the A1 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion is adopted. Senator Peterson, you've got a few guests with you. I don't know if you have any further to talk about the legislation itself or introduce your guests, please.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, we have a couple of folks that we're going to testify in favor of the bill.
Great. I've got Mr. Hoganson and Mr. Tomczak. Who wants to go first here? Mr. Hoganson, if you could introduce yourself for the record, please.
My name is Michael Hoganson. Mr. Chair and members, I appreciate your time. I just have a short little statement here. I started Standard Water Control Systems back in 1977 to waterproof basements. My company works in almost every municipality in Minnesota and parts of Wisconsin, Iowa, and so on. But in the mid-'80s was the first time I was told by an inspector that I needed a plumbing permit to install a sump pump. I was able to get that corrected by contacting the State Code Interpretation Department to get that resolved. And since then, the question of whether a plumbing license and permit is required has come up many times. I found the requirement would change from city to city, municipality to municipality, depending on the building official's interpretation of the code. That would even change if the city would hire a new building official. That official might have a different interpretation of the code. So this confusion and inconsistency has made it very difficult for contractors such as myself to make any long-term plans and for growth and working into the future, not knowing if one day we'll just not be able to do our services. As a business owner and a representative of the Basement Health Association, I'm here to ask you to bring some finality and certainty to this question. To require a plumbing permit to install sump pumps and discharge systems benefits no one, especially the consumer, who would see an average increased cost of $300 to $500 in waterproofing services with little or no increase in value. At this time, when many homeowners are already struggling to find home improvement projects out of reach, contractors also would have additional costs and scheduling problems, having to deal with subcontractors, plumbers, two permits, two inspections, one building permit and one inspection, one plumbing permit and one inspection. All this takes valuable resources that could be used to create more well-paying jobs. Charlie Dernberger said it best. The waterproofing industry has been operating for over 40 years, installing sump pumps and discharge systems with no problems. It makes no sense to require a plumber's license to fix a problem that doesn't exist. We are already licensed by the state as a residential building contractor. To pass this legislation is good for the consumers, good for business, good for jobs, by not adding undue regulation and expense. This bill will also help hundreds of mom-and-pop shops, businesses across Minnesota, northern Minnesota, southern Minnesota, and save countless good-paying jobs. Thank you. If anybody has any questions, I'll be more than happy to.
Thank you, Mr. Hogenson. Let's hear from your comrade there, Mr. Tomczak, too, and then we'll open up for any more committee discussion. Mr. Tomczak, please give your name for the record.
Jack Tomczak. I'm with the Basement Health Association. Just want to, Mr. Chair, members, add one thing. We did speak to our friends at the Associated Builders and Contractors, Minnesota Pipe Trades, National Electrical Contractors, and Minnesota Mechanical Contractors to come up with the language on this, and there seems to be agreement across the board. That's all.
Peace in the valley, as they say, Mr. Tomczak.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Tomczak, you had another witness with you yesterday, as I recall.
She was a little loud. So she is, I left her in the car.
How old is she?
I cracked a window. 7 months.
Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We have to go see that car. I am a little confused about the amendment, Senator. Actually, I like the original bill. And here's the reason. I had visits from different plumbers that are concerned that the Board of Plumbing is expanding its authority over certain practices of construction, and so that more and more they're expanding kind of the regulations, for instance, into gutter installation. And so I was going to propose to amend your original bill. But this, the way I read your amendment and your original bill, I think I'm understanding this language differently. So in your original bill, you simply were asking that the plumbing code will not be regulating sump pumps, because they you're proposing that the state building code regulate that. So that was the original bill. The amendment actually says that waterproofing contractors licensed under this may install. They can already do that. If they have these license under 326B, they are allowed to do that. And I think that the original bill intended to take kind of this installation of pumps out of the process of regulation for plumbing that is put in place by the board. So those are different things, I think. Am I reading this correctly or not?
Senator Peterson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Torres-Ray, we can let the industry comment on that as well, but the original bill that came out, as you can imagine, had significant opposition from organized or union labor relating to plumbing specifically. And so in an effort to try and satisfy their concerns with primarily with work that they would have a better chance of performing in commercial industries, this was the language that they proposed, and the industry related to residential basement health agreed to that, which primarily singles out single-family home construction. If Mr. Tomczak or other folks want to testify to that as well, I certainly would welcome your opinion on that in terms of the amendment.
Mr. Tomczak to Senator Peterson and or Senator Torres-Ray's thoughts.
Mr. Chair, Senator Torres-Ray, the original intent was just to streamline the process so a licensed plumber wasn't required, because it was seen by those in the industry that it wasn't necessary and all it did was add cost. The oversight of the, and Mike, correct me if I'm wrong, but the intent was never to really change who oversees the work. It was just to make it so that the sump pump people who were doing the work could continue unfettered and without the requirement of having a licensed master plumber involved. Make any sense?
Correct. That was the original bill. And I don't know what the problem with that was.
Opposition.
Okay.
And the original language, Senator, was probably too vague. And the amendment we have now was more specific. And some of the concern on the original language was that because it was so vague, it could apply to a single-family home, it could apply to a new Viking stadium, it could apply to any structure. And the industry folks on the plumbing side of things wanted more specificity.
Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the question is why we didn't just put some pumps in a single dwelling or whatever is the language that was... single-family dwelling, sump pumps. That was it. You didn't do that because this language is different. You see, this language says shall not be included in the plumbing code and shall be regulated under the state building code. This is pretty specific. Now you're saying waterproofing contractors licensed under this section may install. And that... You could do that anyway, even before you put this legislation. I mean, you're clarifying now. And so now you're saying, you don't necessarily need a plumber. So you kind of narrow it, and it's, now it's more specific. But you're not changing the law. In here, you were really making sure, and I did want to offer an amendment to include gutters, because I do think that we have a problem in the expansion of the plumbing codes into roofing, which a lot of roofers are very upset about right now because it shouldn't. So we have more and more kind of plumbers included into kind of construction businesses that are not necessarily required. So I was just curious about that. But I don't want to derail Senator Peterson's. I just had an amendment that I thought it was good, and now I am not going to offer it because it doesn't fit.
I think Mr. Hogenson wanted to comment, and I also take Mr. Tomczak, too, to Senator Torres-Ray.
Mr. Chair, Senator, if I could just... Mr. Chair, Senator, if I could just clarify a little bit. What started this is every municipality has a different interpretation of the code. because sump pumps and sump basins and discharge lines are defined in the plumbing code, many cities would then say you need a plumber's permit and a license to install it. Originally, back in the 80s, when I contacted the state interpretation, he says, yes, it's in the plumbing code, but that wasn't the intent of the law. So I was able to get that taken care of, but this has come up time and time again, and has threatened the waterproofing industry to require a plumber's permit. And what we're trying to do is clarify we're already licensed, we are already regulated, hasn't been a problem in our industry. Really, we don't need a plumber's permit to do this. To require that and change it after all this time could potentially put a lot of companies out of business. There's a lot of companies out there that do 100 jobs a year, or maybe 50 jobs a year. To require a plumber's permit to do that, they would have to have a plumber, master plumber, pull the permit, and it would cost them somewhere between $300 and $500. Now, if you're doing 100 jobs, that's about $30,000 a year, and for many of these contractors, that might be all the profit they're making. So it's a jobs bill in that regard, because it could put them out of business. Now, in respect to the gutters, I agree with you there, too. That really, if it's going out the outside of the house, it's got nothing to do with plumbing. But unfortunately, if it's going through the center of a building, once that pipe goes into the building, then there that would be plumbing, defined by the plumbing code, if my understanding. I hope that helps. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hoganson. Senator Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with Senator Torres-Ray that, when we talk about sump pumps, it's not like, we have potable water or we have a water pipe coming into something and then we're, like a dishwasher where we're changing it or we're using it. We're talking about a sump pump here. We're just taking drain water and shooting it out. And you can buy them at any hardware store, anywhere you go. And I'm wondering, what does the code prescribe as far as homeowners with this? Do homeowners have to hire a plumber to hook up a sump pump? And if homeowners don't need to hire a plumber to hook up a sump pump, why would we require a handyman to have a license other than a general contracting license or a license, and bonded? Why would we require them to either be a waterproofing contractor I'm just trying to understand the rationale here.
Senator Howe, I am so tempted to talk about your days in as mayor of Red Wing, going house to house.
Well, we could talk about dishwashers fixing. And permits to get dishwashers.
I was thinking more about his years as a Sears store owner.
Yeah, exactly.
We sold a lot of them, by the way.
I think you might have the right people here, at least for some of those answers. Mr. Hoganson, did you have has that triggered a thought based upon Senator Howe's comments and question?
Mr. Chair, Senator, you are absolutely correct. A homeowner does not need a license to do anything to their own home. Technically, for example, if he was to do some wiring, he's supposed to pull a permit and have it inspected. I don't think you're going to find any homeowner pulling a permit for a sump pump, nor would it be required. If the home has a drain tile system hooked up to the sanitary sewer system, which is a problem here, and was a problem in St. Paul especially back in the early 80s when they went through and separated the sewer and water systems, every home had to be inspected. At that point, once they found that drain tile was going into the sanitary sewer system, then, of course, a homeowner would have to pull a permit and get that fixed. But he still could do it himself. So technically, homeowners are supposed to pull permits, but they do the work all the time by themselves.
Senator Howe.
So, follow up, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I'm just wondering, people are in the business of doing this, and homeowners aren't required. I appreciate the compromise here, but it doesn't seem like we're making a significant enough change to warrant even a change. But that's, I guess, just my perspective from
Senator Peterson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Howe and members, really the goal for the record, you know, it's, I guess there was Department of Labor staff here, but I think they've left. Oh, here he is. But for the record, you know, oftentimes state staff will now, if this moves forward and is passed, state staff will interpret this. And the goal of this legislation that we have is covered. As you can imagine, when a basement health contractor goes in to remodel a basement as a licensed general contractor, they would go to the city and pull that permit. What was happening before, to do a sump pump, they would have to actually also get a plumbing permit. The goal of this legislation, for the record, is that a basement health contractor can go to the city, get one permit under their building permit to remodel a basement, to help dry that basement down, to put in drain tiles, to sheetrock the basement, whatever they need to do. All can be done under one permit. That's the remodeling permit that they would go and get from the city. Is that an accurate description, Mr. Hoganson?
Yeah. Yes, it is.
So that's, for the record, Mr. Chair and members, that's our goal. If there is a different interpretation from the Department of Labor, you know, we will have some concerns over that. So,
very good. Is there anyone else wishing to testify on Senate File 1993? Thank you. Thank you, Senator Peterson. So Senator Peterson moves that Senate File 1993 be recommended to pass, and this can be sent to the floor. There's no fiscal impact here. As amended, absolutely. Senate File 1993 as amended. Be recommended to pass and sent to the floor. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed nay. Motion's adopted. Senator Peterson, you're kind of two for two. Not sure the first one counted as much. So now we'll take up Senate File 2326.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We have before you today Senate File 2326. We're going from sump pumps to barbers.
You're a renaissance man, Senator Peterson. You do it all.
Mr. Chair and members, Senate File 2326 represents, again, I think some great collaborative work I've been shown, that there's been industry members working together. These efforts are between the Board of Barber Examiners, members of the barbering community, including barber school operators, instructors, registered master barbers, barbershop owners, as well as apprentice and student barbers, have all come together with some work on the task force in the past. These are the recommendations that they've come up with that are long overdue. I've clearly been shown that they're justified and fair, and my hope is that we can present that information to you and show you that that's something you can accept as well. We have some folks involved in the industry to testify to that effect as well.
Great. Well, welcome to the Jobs Committee, and thank you also for your patience. Who wants to go first?
I can.
Okay. Could you identify yourself for the record, please?
Mr. Chair, I'm Thora Fisco, and I'm the Executive Secretary for the Board of Barber Examiners. And I thank you and the committee members for hearing us today. I'm here today simply to express the board's support for this bill for Senate File 2326. As Senator Peterson stated, this bill is the result of collaboration. The Board of Examiners put together a task force formed of board members, barber school owners, instructors, registered or commonly known as master barbers, apprentice barbers, barbershop owner. We had a nice group of people that got together. The task force met several times and worked to build consensus among the members in developing a proposal. The result, we believe, is a bill that maintains the board's mission of public safety while being supportive of the barbering profession. And the board fully supports this bill. And I thank you.
Great. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. If you could give your name for the record.
My name is Peggy Schmidt. I am the owner and instructor of the Minnesota School of Barbering on East Lake Street. I have operated that barber school for 26 years. I've been a barber since 1970. And I'm here to answer any questions you might have about barber poles.
Do you think there might be a few questions?
Well, no. We've had a little we've had a couple interviews with Minnesota Public Radio, and then there's been a couple of articles in a couple of magazines, and I thought if you had some questions, I could clarify them.
Well, and, you know, I thank you for that offer. I wonder, I think it'd probably be worth a couple minutes, at least to just summarize it. I happened to catch one of the news channels did some TV news on this last night. But maybe could you just kind of outline the issue for committee? Because if we don't have an understanding of it now, we're likely to get asked a question about it, and we want to do good things for Senator Peterson and make sure he hasn't slid one by us here. So, Mr. Schmidt, if you could just give us a little, what do we need to know about this?
Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the Senate, first let me tell you that the Barber pole has been around almost as long as the cross. It is a universal sign for barbering services. The red represents the blood because barbers and surgeons at one point were one. The white was the bandages. The blue was for the veins because they also did cupping and leeching. And the pole itself was actually a staff for you to hold while you were being bled. So it was something for you to grab a hold of. The bottom of the barber pole right now is kind of a stainless steel vessel, but back in the day it was used to catch the blood when you were being bled. And then evolved into a basin to shape, to keep clean water to after you were shaved, that splash your face. The barbers feel that that's our trademark. When you see a barber pole, you know that you're going to go inside that establishment and you're going to find licensed master barbers. Now, it's not our intention to eliminate barber poles from, for an example, O'Gara's. O'Gara's has a barber pole. It has a barber chair, and you can get a shot of tequila in the barber chair.
I didn't know that.
We just want to make sure that if you are putting a barber pole in front of your establishment, that you are indeed a master barber.
Yeah.
Like McDonald's. McDonald's has the golden arches. When you go into McDonald's, you know you're going to get a Big Mac. If you want to go get a Whopper, you're going to go to Burger King. I can't imagine any place in this town putting up golden arches in front of a burger joint without McDonald's going crazy. And we just would like to keep the barber pole kind of associated with master barbers.
And so, Ms. Schmidt or Senator Peterson, so is there language specific to the barber pole in this legislation?
Yes. Yeah, Mr. Chair and members, it's on Section 18, which is on page 8.
And Senator Peterson or Ms. Schmidt, there's kind of there's a neat Minnesota angle to all this, because am I right to remember that the only company manufacturing these poles now is, I think it's kind of a one-man shop out of, is it St. Paul?
It is. Mr. Chairman,
Ms. Schmidt,
members of the committee. Marvy's Barber Pole is the last official barber pole manufacturer in the United States. Also, it should be noted that Minnesota had the first barber laws, and we had the first, I think we had the first barber board as well to regulate health and safety. So Minnesota's kind of always been kind of a leader in the barbering industry. If you would like, I could read that paragraph to you.
Senator Metzen says he doesn't like
to read. I just read it.
But I appreciate you
read it.
Spending a little extra time on that issue, because it is something that has come up or might come up again. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on Senate File 2326? I mean, it's hard for me not to notice the greatest barber in the state office building is in the room.
The only one.
Ken, nice to see you. Have they done okay? Are you okay with the test? Okay. Okay. I've spent a lot of time in Ken's chair. Any concluding remarks from you, Senator Peterson, or questions from
Mr.
members?
Chairman, yeah. Before you go into the remarks, sure. I have an amendment.
Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you. Mr. Peterson, it just came to my attention late that the retaking of the examination is usually taken by people whose English is their second language. And as a result of it, they are taking the exam multiple times. And $45 every time seems like a lot. So I would like to put an amendment to line 122 and line 24 to bring 45 down to 10 in both. So that's my amendment.
Senate Council is going to make sure we grab that, Senator Torres Ray, if you could just repeat that and make sure we're all on the same page.
Mr. Chair and members and Senator Torres Ray, I think we're talking about Section 2 of the bill under the fees. On page 1, line 1.22, delete 45 and insert 10. And on line 1.24, delete 40 and insert 10.
Ms. Schmidt, we'll give you a chance to respond to the amendment.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Torres, I think it's a great idea as well. It's, you know, we're comfortable with that, but I'd also like to make a note at this time that in the state of Minnesota, if you are a foreign language person, you are allowed to bring an interpreter with you when you take your written exam. Unlike some of the other boards, if you are going to be a barber, you can bring somebody with you.
Thank you.
Senator Peterson, to the amendment, or are you?
Mr. Chair, yes, we would certainly accept that suggestion and appreciate the effort you took in reading the bill and bringing that out.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Jensen has
I would call the committee's attention to the fiscal note. This bill, as originally written, costs the general fund $32,000 a year. And my question would be, do we send this to finance, and how do we cover that cost?
Thank you for noting that, Mr. Jensen. So, members, you do have it's actually a four-page fiscal note, and this we're told that the judiciary needs to see this bill as well. But
Mr. Chairman,
sounds
I know
like finance.
It's a very small amount, big picture, but just making that note.
Further discussion on the Torres Ray Amendment? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed nay. Amendment is adopted. Thank you, Senator Torres Ray. Thank you, Mr. Jensen. So, members, we have been asked to send this to Judiciary. Are you guys ready to do this again? Okay. So, Senator Peterson moves that Senate File 2326 be recommended to pass and sent to Judiciary. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed nay. Motion's adopted. Senator Peterson, kind of 3 for 3 then. If I had a hat, I'd throw it. All right, Senator Lilly. And if Mr. Nelson and Mr. Alexander, if you could join Senator Lilly at the table. Members, I'm going to make a guess here. I'm looking at the time and knowing that we have some issues to deal with this bill, and also noting that Senator Nelson has been detained down at, I think it's the Education Committee. We'll take all the testimony that we can on this bill. If it's ready to go by 6, we can move it, but the intent then would be to carry over Senator Nelson's bill until tomorrow morning, Siri, which is scheduled for tomorrow morning at 8:30. So we'll be able to take up that. And I also know from a staff standpoint, we're stretching our staff a little bit on amendments and language, and just seeing that it's already 20 minutes to 6, I don't want to push people any further, especially since we don't even have the author in the room. So at least an announcement for those in the room that we're waiting on Senator Nelson's bill. We will not act on that this evening. We might do some work on it, and I know staff will be working on it, but the committee won't act. So Senator Lilly to Senate File 2290.
Yes, Mr. Chair and members. This may seem a little bit familiar to you. In fact, it may seem like deja vu all over again from our meeting earlier this week. We are talking about the Angel Investment Tax Credit, which, again, just by way of introduction, is an innovative, small, affects innovative small businesses that apply proprietary technologies working on research, development, and production processes. This tax credit applies to businesses with less than 25 employees, have equity of less than $4 million. And basically what we're working on in this bill is some technical changes to the bill that have been put forward by the department. At the same time, I state that fully with the understanding that we've had lengthy discussion about previous bills and about the next bill that's to come, the Nelson bill, and I'm assuming that we'll be doing some work on this one. So, members, that is basically the bill.
And thank you, Senator Lilly, and also for members. So this is, I guess what we have that is new that I think is important for this committee to hear is Mr. Nelson, who's the Angel Tax Program Coordinator. We did not have the luxury and benefit of your testimony the other day, and you and I sat together in tax committee this morning. But I know you have a handout that everyone should have now, and I just think it's important for us to lay a little more groundwork and history on the on this Angel Tax program that you're running, and it's a good story. So we'll turn to you first, Mr. Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jeff Nelson. I'm the work for the Department of Employment and Economic Development and run the Angel Tax Credit Program. I'd like to take just a few moments to sort of review what the program is, and then I'll talk about a few of the highlights and results of the program. As Senator Lilly indicated, the Angel Tax Credit is a 25% tax credit for investors who invest in qualified businesses. Qualified businesses under the program are primarily high-tech businesses. There are, however, some extra types of companies, any of those companies that are using some sort of proprietary technology in various areas such as manufacturing, mining, minerals, et cetera. We have three types of entities that participate in the program. One, the investors, those that individually put money into these new high-tech emerging businesses. Two, we have funds, angel funds, groups of individuals, at least three, who pool their money together and invest in the same types of businesses. And then third, we have the businesses themselves. We have a number of requirements for these businesses. They must be headquartered in Minnesota. Over half their employees and half their payroll must be in Minnesota. They must have fewer than 25 employees. They must pay their employees a wage that's at least 175% of the poverty level for a family of four. The intent of the legislature when the program was first initially passed was that we were going to put our resources into the high-tech industry, a high-wage industry. That amount, 175% of the poverty level for four, is just short of $40,000 a year. Also, the company cannot have been in operation for more than 10 years and cannot have received more than $4 million in equity investments. So again, we're dealing with high-tech businesses, those that are dealing with proprietary technology in a high-tech field. Let me transition here a little bit, and I'm going to talk about some of the results of the program. You'll see that the program has grown greatly between 2010 and 2011, though I will note the program began in July of 2010, so we really only did have a half a year in the first year. In 2010, we had 67 businesses that were invested in. In 2011, that grew to 113 small high-tech businesses. The number of investors that participated in the program and actually made investments also increased greatly. It went from 258 in 2010 to 563 in 2011. And for the funds, four invested in 2010, whereas 21 invested in 2011. Now, that's all in good, but the real point is how much money was invested then in these small high-tech businesses? Did they get the capital that they needed to grow? In 2010, $28 million was invested in small high-tech businesses in Minnesota via the program. In 2011, that jumped to $63.2 million. The tax credit itself is a refundable credit. What that means is that if on your tax return you don't have sufficient tax liability to cover the credit, meaning that you would not be able to use the entire credit, the refundability feature means that if there's a difference, you get a check from the Department of Revenue. The reason that's important is that we have a lot of investors who are from outside of Minnesota who have no Minnesota tax liability. Because of the refundability feature, they can participate in the program. In fact, about 30% of the investors and 30% of the investment comes from outside of Minnesota. And I'll just say anecdotally, a lot of it seems to come from Naples, Florida. The average investment in 2010 was about $96,000. That dropped a little bit in 2011. Part of that is because more funds were involved. We had more individual investors investing via a fund, and therefore the average investment dropped a little bit. Between 2010 and 2011, we had the same kinds of businesses receiving most of the investment. The top four in both years was medical devices, software, biotech, and clean tech. One of the concerns we had with the program last year, as we reported to the legislature, was that there was a concentration of investment in the metro area as opposed to greater Minnesota. In the metro area, in 2010, our first year, we had 61 businesses invested in the metro area and six in greater Minnesota. In 2011, we about doubled the number of companies that were invested in greater Minnesota. That jumped from 6 to 13. And then the metro, it went from, again, 61 to 100. The amount of investment, however, in greater Minnesota didn't just double like the number of businesses. It went up about 600%. It went from just short of $2 million to almost $13 million. So while the number of businesses did double, we were very fortunate and glad to see that the amount of investment invested in greater Minnesota increased dramatically.
Mr. Chair?
Still not enough. Senator Nelson.
Could you tell me what the metro investment grew from $26 million to what?
From $26 million to $50 million.
To $50 million. Thank you.
Mr. Nelson.
I'd like to take just a quick moment to recap a few other figures. Again, we did have a much greater level of participation in the program in 2011 versus 2012. On the number of businesses certified, not necessarily those receiving investment, but the number of businesses certified went from 112 in 2010 to 176 in 2011. Correspondingly, the number of investors who participated in the program, not necessarily invested, but participated in the program, grew from 275 to 623. And the number of funds went from 5 to 21. Mr. Chair, I would be willing to take any questions that people might have.
So, Mr. Nelson, I appreciate the background, and I think this, I wish we'd had this benefit of this the other day. But the two things I was hoping to get some more of your testimony on and get the members' discussion on, again, was on the wage issue and then also the geographic dispersal, which you touched on a little bit. So why don't we take them in reverse, just because I had the benefit of hearing you this morning at the Tax Committee. So the department and the program that you're running apparently have been pretty sensitive to this, for lack of a better description, this metro versus outstate. And I think you're trying to combine resources with this angel network, and you've had outstate meetings. Can you just give a little more about how you've spent the last year trying to spread this program across the state?
Mr. Chair, yes. In our 2010 annual report, we did note, as I indicated earlier, that we were disturbed that the investment in greater Minnesota businesses was fairly low, in both in terms of numbers and amount. As a result of that, we began an outreach effort in 2011. In 2011. We met with over a dozen groups in greater Minnesota as part of an education effort to make businesses, economic developers, and investors aware of the Angel Tax Credit Program. I think part of the increase that we saw from 2010 to 2011 was a result of some of those meetings. We've also partnered with a number of organizations. One of the biggest is the newly hatched Minnesota Angel Network. This is a nonprofit organization. It's part of the Life Science Alley group. And what they are doing is they're basically serving as mentors to both businesses and investors to teach them about angel investing, to get the businesses in a position where they can and should be meeting with potential investors. And in terms of investors, it's really an introduction to what angel investing is. Most folks are very familiar with investing in stocks and bonds and putting their money into money markets, but they might not be aware that in their communities there are businessmen, businesswomen looking to start their own businesses and need capital to grow. I'm actually working directly with the Minnesota Angel Network and with the businesses that they take applications from for participating in their program. And they have just developed and are opening up 4 different intake centers throughout greater Minnesota so that businesses have greater access to this means of participating in the program.
And Mr. Nelson, I thought I heard you say something like you've had 11 seminars or programs across the state describing this program and trying to, again, kind of spread the word.
Mr. Chair, yes, that is correct. So myself and my director have been both throughout the entire state meeting with different groups and talking about the program.
And then, Mr. Alexander, may we bring you into this conversation?
Certainly.
Why don't you give your name and background again for the committee, and then if you had a thought on the kind of geographic dispersal and just kind of the general education effort on, yes, we have this program and who knows about it.
Certainly, Mr. Chair. My name is John Alexander. I was brought to Minnesota 20 years ago by one of the major medical device companies. I was an officer of that company. When I left that, I started my own medical device firm. I've run 3 since then, have done a number of turnarounds. I'm also the creator of Twin Cities Angels, the largest angel fund in the area. We are on our 2nd fund, and I've been participating in the Angel Investment Tax Credit since 2000. Let's see, your question was on geography. There are a couple of factors at work. One, roughly half the population of the state of Minnesota is inside the greater metro area. There are a wide variety of things within that geography that tends to attract people, highly skilled, highly educated, from schools to cultural events to camaraderie to a variety of other entertainment activities that tends to draw people in with these types of skills, not to mention the University of Minnesota. And my personal concentration is in medical, although I've dabbled in other technologies as well. So there's that sort of dynamic going on. The other component in the Minnesota Angel Investment Tax Credit, which is different from, I did some research while in between our last meeting, and I believe there are only 2 other states right now that have minimum wage requirements, is that if you've got a disparity in wage rates across a region, then where that threshold is greater than what the economics require, companies don't get funded there. And so when this law was put in place in 2010, I got a long list of emails from CEOs in outstate Minnesota who said, great idea, I can't use it. I've got people that will take significantly less. They'll take less than $40,000 a year to do a job they need. I can't take it if I've got to raise everybody's salary. I become non-competitive. I think it's worth noting that people that go into emerging technology companies do for a variety of reasons. They tend to be more experienced. They tend to be interested in the excitement of an emerging technology company. They tend to be able to let their creative juices go. They also like the equity. And so they might work, I know I have, for a lot less cash compensation than I would get in a large company. But I get a share of the equity, which may bear fruit 2, 3, 5, 8, 10 years later. And so the dynamics don't lend themselves to situations like you might see in other environments where price controls have been shown to be effective.
And then I know I have one more member from the audience who wants to testify on this bill. Mr. Schley, so you
just didn't heard something.
Okay, great. Thank you. I wonder if Senator Metzen, I want to give you at least an opportunity to talk about your concerns about the wage level. And we have Mr. Nelson and Mr. Alexander here who could be a part of that discussion. I appreciate you sharing it with me.
Mr. Chair?
I suspect that we'll...
I have one question real quick here that they may, and they sure. might have answered it. Of the 176 companies that were certified in 2011, do you have the breakdown of those 176 metro to non-metro? Because I'd like to know how many applied versus how many are actually getting invested in the greater area.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I'm sorry, I do not. We... does not break it down by metro versus non-metro. We track those businesses that actually receive investment in terms of location. We do not track the ones that don't.
So I'm not trying to surprise you, Senator Metzen, but I just thought we have some good experience at the table here. And
you surprised me quite a bit, Mr. Chairman. But
well, you surprised me earlier today.
Yeah. What I would like to do I'm going to have a couple of my colleagues maybe ask you a couple of questions, too, on the wages and why. I mean, when I drafted the bill along 3-4 years ago or carried it, oftentimes around here when we give state incentives, we tie wages to that. And that's what we did. And these are high-tech jobs usually. And... it's another reason why they should get paid 175 and not one. So that was the thinking back then. They're getting subsidized with state contributions. And I have not heard, and I don't know, somebody at the desk up in front might know, of any business that has received these monies. I have not heard of any that have complained about the 175. Now, I could be corrected on that, but I followed this stuff for about 4 years, and nobody's come to me and said, you know, we're not hiring because of the 175.
And I don't know if Mr. Alexander or Mr. Nelson want to opine on that. Yeah, I'm not sure you'd hear that they're not going to.
Mr. Chair, I would be happy to forward some of the emails I have from CEOs that replayed what I reported earlier about not being able to take the money because of the relatively high wages. And perhaps if I can clarify for just a second.
I don't agree that they're high wages, I mean, but go ahead.
No, and I wouldn't either,
Mr.
but
Alexander.
There is a continuum of an emerging technology company. I mean, in the very early stages, cash is king, and getting compensated in equity is a reasonable trade-off. Once you get to the size of, you know, not even a Medtronic or a St. Jude Medical, but a Vascular Solutions, a Urologix, some of these more modest companies that have 100, 200, 300 people, those wages go to market, you know, and they get a bonus that's market, and they might not get any equity at all. But the people that were there early, like the early people at Apple Computer, everybody who walked in the door in the first 5 years got equity. There were secretaries there that were multimillionaires. But a secretary that joins Medtronic right now gets $36,000 a year plus benefits. And so in the very earlier stages, people are willing to make that trade-off if they have the right skills. And if they can't, they don't take the job. Or if the salary is not enough, they don't take the job. And so the market really balances the equation really quite well unless there's a another threshold, which is, I think, is what we've got here.
Chairman.
Senator,
one more point. I didn't want to bring this into the conversation, but I had some discussion with the Deed and the governor's folks, and I feel strongly about this legislation, and I want it to get passed. And the governor is very serious about the 175, and I communicated with the Deed and others, and they've expressed that I want the bill to pass, and if it takes the 175, and we'll go forward. But I'm afraid that if it's not in there, we could very easily lose this fight.
I appreciate that, Senator Metzen. Again, this was something you just brought to me this week, and
yeah.
So I thought it'd be helpful since we had literally the person who's running the program and the person who helped write the legislation back with you a couple years ago get their thoughts on the record. I don't know, Mr. Nelson, if you have anything on the 175
issue. Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to share some additional information.
Thank you.
There is the wage minimum of approximately $40,000 a year. It's on an annualized basis. It does include fringe benefits. I have had a number of instances where someone's close, and so what I do is I write back to the company and say, okay, you told me this is their wage, but have you factored in health benefits, vacation, overtime pay, et cetera? I've had very few instances where meeting this threshold is a problem. I would say that two-thirds of the companies, it's no problem at all because they are pre-payroll. They have no employees yet. In addition, the compensation minimum does not apply to anyone who's an executive officer of the company, who's a board member, or who receives equity investment and has more than 20% of the company. All those folks are excluded from the wage minimum. We also have a different floor for interns. This was something that was passed last year. It's approximately $12.50 an hour for interns. So I've had six companies where I've asked, now, is this person an intern? Because this wage looks really low. And they go, oh, yes. And so it's that fix that we made last year has had a real good effect.
Mr. Chairman?
Just also anecdotally, you asked if any companies had complained to me about the minimum, and I have not received any complaints. When the companies do have employees, and I require them to send in a payroll register because we need to verify that these wages are being met, these, again, as Mr. Alexander said, these are high-tech people. $40,000 is usually the wage is $60, $80, $100, $120. So $40,000, as some have said to me, well, that's not in the pay range of the people that we need to hire to get our business going.
Thank you, Senator. Mr. Nelson. Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just a little confused because I don't see any provisions in here in your bill, Senator Lilly, related to this conversation.
That's right, Senator Torres-Ray. So we have one of these angel tax bills now in the tax committee, but we didn't have the benefit of Mr. Nelson here when this committee dealt with that issue.
Okay.
And so now we have at least two more bills. Yeah.
So this bill is okay.
Matt's saying this bill's okay.
Mr. Chairman, I think it's okay because it has the 175 in it. I commend Senator Lilly for...
Thank you for the clarification. Wasn't sure.
Doing the right thing, Senator Lilly.
Senator Tomasoni.
Mr. Chairman, and I don't want to quibble here, but Senator Metzen didn't bring that issue to you. You brought it to us when you deleted it in your bill. And it sounds to me like it's not a problem, though.
Senator Tomasoni, I gave Senator Metzen that bill in January.
Well, you were the chief.
Yeah, but Mr. Chair, I trust you. I have faith in
you,
and I don't cross every T and dot every I.
I mean, he wasn't the author.
You're my.
No,
everyone's trying to work in a constructive way here, and I'm just thinking we got the experts at the table here, so I thought it'd be helpful.
It sounds like it's okay to me, and it sounds like Senator Lilly's bill is okay, and I think we have peace in the valley on Senator Nelson's bill. We might as well pass that out of here tonight too.
Yeah, we don't. I'm not sure we're going to get to that, Senator Thompson. So we have Mr. Schley.
Cheers.
Why don't you join us?
It's ready.
We'll get her done.
Why don't? You guys flip a coin to see who's... Yep, okay,
sorry.
You can bring up a...
Slide over. Slide in.
I'm not sure if Mr. Slay's going to speak to these last two issues. He might have some others, but I know he has some technical background with this law and has been helpful to Deed in the past. So, Mr. Slay, we also didn't have the benefit of your counsel 2 days ago, so we're making up for it a little bit.
Yes. Thank you, Chairman, members. My name is Michael Schley. I'm an attorney at the Larkin Hoffman Law Firm. I'm not here on behalf of a client today. I have experience with the bill in that I wrote the deeds book describing it that they give as a handout. I also participated with Mr. Nelson's various hearings, informal, but I laud him for it in considering the precise manner in which the bill was going to be applied. I want to speak to the wage issue. However, I also want to first mention that the language that the bill uses to deal with the loophole, the company that raises money and then merges with a public company, I think needs to be looked at again by staff. Right now, if a credit is issued, there are penalties that are imposed upon the investor if he or she disposes of his or her stock too soon. They have to give the credit back. and there are penalties imposed upon the company if they don't meet requirements such as remaining in Minnesota, they have to pay a penalty substantially the same as if the credit was coming back, but the investors are not subject to any sort of loss there. The wording that's in the bill now, the language that's in the bill now, essentially takes and uses the definition of the company.
Mr. Schleib, just for my benefit and for Senator Torres-Ray, too.
Certainly.
Are you speaking to the bill that Senator Lilly is carrying?
No, I'm not. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, then if you could.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Nelson.
I believe that the language to which Mr. Schleib is referring to is in Senator Lilly's bill. It was also in
the bill,
from the other day.
Yes. Actually, I will correct myself. There is language in this bill as well. You're right. Thank you very much for the correction. All I'm asking, I agree with the intention.
Mr. Schleib, I just have staff asking, can you point out
certainly
the actual language?
Yeah. And certainly. If you go to page 3, line 3.3, and page 4, lines 4.5 through 4.9, they're the circumstances that are attempted to being dealt with that are seen as a problem. Again, I don't disagree with the change. The problem is that this is in the definitional section of what a qualified small businesses, and if the business qualifies at the time the investment is made, and then one of these events happens post-investment, I don't think we accomplish what you want to do, because as an investor, I made my investment when the company was qualified. If this does do that, however, the problem becomes, is this a give-up of the credit by the investor who had no knowledge, perhaps, of the fact that the company was going to do this transaction, or is this a penalty imposed upon the company? Again, all I'm saying is that this is unclear, and I apologize. I sent a handout over yesterday, but it was quite late in the day, and I didn't bring enough copies to hand out on the second issue. I should have apologized at the beginning. So, I agree with the intention. I just don't think the wording does what it's supposed to do. The second issue that I want to speak to is on the wages and the required 175%. My experience is a bit different in that I hear from companies who come to me before they're at the application stage saying that, I'd like to go apply for this. Do I qualify? And I start out with, are you located in Minnesota? Have you been in business more than 10 years? Do you fall into one of the categories of the permitted businesses? Do you have a bad boy involved with you? And then I get to, do you meet the minimum wage requirements? And the answer is quite often, no. Well, can you give your people raises such that you will? And the problem that we run into is that the dollar amount that's required is so high and so out of line that it doesn't make sense. Now, the required wage is set by reference to the poverty level for a family of four published by the Department of Labor. So it gets reset every year as the Department of Labor adjusts that. Right now it's at, I forget if it's 1855 or 1885, but it's in that range. The problem that you have is that so many businesses who employ people that are not the technicians, not the scientists, that the median wages for many of those people, both here in the metro, but more significantly outstate, fall below that level. And again, this is the handout that I apologize. For example, if I'm a business and I employ a secretary and part-time or full-time, adjust the rate, unless I'm paying that secretary the $18.55 per hour, I'm not eligible. The median, half are paid above, half are paid below, statewide is $18.30. But in some regions, it's much lower. If I have a bookkeeping person who is doing bookkeeping, not a CPA, but the person who comes in and balances my checkbook and pays my bills and so forth, the wages on that range down into the $15 range outstate, and here in the metro are under the $18.55 level. And if I get to more I don't want to use the word unskilled, but if I get down to, for example, mail clerks or machine operators, the wage levels at the median point are $9.54 in some parts of the state. And so the imposition or the making this credit conditional upon the company paying wages well in excess of what is being paid in the market is inappropriate. And by the way, the statistics are drawn from Deeds website, the reports that they have issued. There also is not an exception for family members. So if I'm the founder of the business and somebody else is a 20% owner and we ask our kids to come in after school and sweep the floors, we have to pay them $18.55 because the exception is for us personally. So the amendment that we're talking about in the other bill to eliminate that, I have to say, is going to be a major issue in terms of the clients that I and potential clients that I advise when they come to me, and I have to tell them, unhappily, you don't meet this requirement. Now, the point was made that many businesses are just the founders themselves, and that's true, and those people would not be affected by this. But that says that if you don't get your credit right away, if you get to the point where you've started hiring people, particularly non-technical people, you've lost your opportunity to do the credit. That's my point.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Keeley.
Just to follow up on that. Well, part of the goal of this is to get the higher tech jobs, the higher paying jobs, not the lower paying jobs, and trying to develop that. I mean, this isn't specifically about any and all investments. This is in a higher – the goal is to find higher tech companies to grow. Somebody that's in a, I mean, and part of this is that what we're doing is we're giving those folks that have enough money in their pocket to invest a huge credit, and we can't even make sure that that huge credit is going to compensate somebody on the lower end of the pay scale at least a decent, a halfway decent wage. And I don't consider that $38,000 to be an exorbitant amount of money by any stretch of the imagination. So I'm finding that, you know, once again we seem to be giving investors a break. At the same time, we're not willing to stand up for the guy that's working for him. And so, you know, I'm with Senator Metzen on this. This needs to, that 175% of poverty is a good thing to have, and it's what the cost of getting the credit is for. You know, part of what we're giving them the credit for is to have high-tech jobs. And, you know, if a company doesn't have high-tech jobs to offer because they're paying lower wages and they can't afford to do that, well, then they don't qualify for the program. But that's part of the reason it was put in there in the first place, to make sure that we're not just growing low-wage jobs, we're growing high-wage jobs. So it's the 175 is not there to... limit to, well, it is there to limit anybody that wants to get this investment credit. It's there to focus on higher tech, higher skilled, higher paying jobs. So,
Senator, may I respond? Mr. Chairman, may I respond?
Shall I? Mm-hmm.
I absolutely agree. The goal is to create jobs that will be at the higher paying level. The problem is with just the wording, in that it applies to absolutely everybody who's there. And so to the extent, one of the pieces of advice that I've given a client is don't do your own bookkeeping. Hire a bookkeeping service, because they are not considered employees. They are not subject to the wage level. But now all of a sudden that means that my client has to put another level, another company in place, and pay them their profit. There's no reason for that. And I'm not looking to have people be paid below standard wages. You know, and I'm not proposing it, but if there was a provision that said you will pay at least the median for the job title in the district, I think it's more complicated than need be, but I certainly wouldn't object to that. The problem that I have is setting an 1855 level that applies to people in whatever job they have. But to the extent we're talking the technical people, they won't be the issue. It's the ancillary people that a business is required to have.
Mr. Alexander, on that point?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To augment Mr. Schley's point, this goes back to the continuum and the evolution of an early stage company. At the very earliest stages, you may be very dependent upon people that, in a disproportionate way, that their market rate is below this wage. But as you get larger, as you get to a larger size company, as you have critical mass, and you're hiring many more engineers and scientists and manufacturing folks and so on, that's when we get to that stage. What we're trying to do is nurture the companies through this very early stage to the point in which they can have those types of jobs and be hiring hundreds of people, not under 25. So we're trying to get them over that initial hump. But pay the market.
Mr. Chairman, may I add one comment I forgot?
I'm going to look to Senator Lilly, who was ready to make a comment too.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Kielash, the other issue I think is really important is I think the Angel Fund, the tax credit, is an attempt. We have a great resource at the U of M and at our colleges throughout the state, and we're trying to keep these businesses, these feeder or these beginning businesses, in the state of Minnesota. And if we have this limit on wages, there's the chance that they will look to locate elsewhere. And then we've lost that opportunity to have a company like Medtronic or 3M or St. Jude develop and evolve in the state of Minnesota versus someplace else. So I think it is important that we look at what we're trying to achieve, and I agree with you. We do want the high-paying jobs, but we want these companies to invest in Minnesota and stay here. We've trained them. We've educated them. They've grown through their research in Minnesota, and this is an attempt to keep these businesses here versus going to a neighboring state or someplace else.
Mr. Chair, can I follow up? Mr. Nelson, one of the things that I keep running, we're talking about all these other businesses, but it seems to me that we have an awful lot of angel investors and businesses that are managing to meet these requirements. Is there some limit on who's qualified that I'm missing here, or are we turning away that many people? Is there enough money in the pot, et cetera, to make this all work? Is the companies the other two folks there are talking about really leaving the state because of paying this wage?
Mr. Chair.
It was to Mr. Nelson. The question was this. Well,
Then Mr. Nelson.
Yes, if I could answer first. Mr. Chair, Senator Kielash, I think one of the issues is what we were referring to earlier with Senator Nelson's bill on angel credits, and that is greater Minnesota. If the wages are different in the metro area versus greater Minnesota, then perhaps by instituting this wage floor, we're limiting the number of businesses that will locate in the rest of the state versus in the metro area. So I think that is a piece of what we're talking about here also.
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chair, Senator, in 2011, we had $12 million in credits that we could allocate, plus $4 million that were carried over from the previous year. You'll remember that 2010 was just half a year, so we had $11 allotment, and we didn't go through it all. So we had $16 million that we could allocate last year. That $16 million was fully allocated by mid-November. So we went through all of the credits that we had available to companies that did meet the wage minimum by mid-November. This year, we have $12 million in credits that we are able to grant, and I anticipate we will have a run rate. If we use the same run rate as we did last year, we will have granted all our credits by possibly mid-July, again, to all companies that could meet these wage minimums.
Senator Metzen?
Yeah, I just want to say one more time that the director, the gentleman that's in the trenches, administrates the program, has said three times at the podium the wage thing is not an issue. I mean, he's what I would call a boss. He runs the show, and he's putting all this money out. And nobody's complaining except a couple of people here. He knows what he's doing. He's doing a good job. And it's not a problem, the wage thing. So let's try to grasp that and understand it here. It's not a problem.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Schley?
Mr. Nelson is correct that the money is being all used up. And there's another amendment that's pending that would increase that number to $20 million. Even if amended, the money would all be used up. The issue, though, is at what level are people eligible to get the credit? If I have clients who come in who've been through a couple of rounds and they have angels who are probably going to invest anyway, or it's not going to take a lot to push them into the making the investment, this credit is helpful, but it is not critical. If I've got the smaller business that does not yet have the angels persuaded that this is the right business, that the upside is as great, the credit will be far more valuable, and the change here will make it much more valuable to the smaller businesses, which, as the senator said, are the businesses outstate. This will affect them more than the metro ones.
Chairman, I'm surprised that the witness said these credits are just helpful. Hopefully they're more important than just being helpful.
I have Mr. Alexander.
To augment the point again, my estimation is that the vast majority of what Mr. Nelson sees are companies that have the capability of applying because they've read the criteria on the website or talked to an expert that might know it. But as an angel group that's seen over 500 companies since we started and has a long list of those that did not meet the criteria, as well as angry letters from CEOs when the bill was initially passed that says, I can't take it because I'm not going to pay the guy who sweeps the floors $18.55 an hour. And Mr. Schley has given a long list of examples. There are companies out there. Now, if your objective is to just use up the funds, we will help a subset of the companies that could apply. If one of your objectives is to broaden the use of it beyond the metro area to a broader extent without picking winners and losers, I would say release the job requirements so that any company can do it regardless of what the job requirements are. Because if somebody is offered a job that is below what they're willing to take, they won't take it.
Maybe we could combine them. Well, Mr. Chairman, I would love to get this bill out of here now, but it seems to me that we're beating a dead horse, because not only did Deed use all $16 million worth of credits in 2011, they could have used $18 million worth of credits had they had the money. But if we're going through the allocation, what we're being told is that if you would lower the wage threshold, that we could create a whole bunch of low-wage jobs for you, and that's not what the program's all about. The program's about creating high-wage jobs, and it's happening because we're going through our total allocation. In fact, we're trying to up it to $20 million. So it seems to me that we should continue down this road of paying people so that they can actually buy groceries and buy a car and buy a house and buy insurance, because that's what the whole goal of the program is. Now, if we weren't going through the credits and we weren't finding companies that were eligible, that would be a whole different discussion. But it sounds to me like we're finding the companies that we want.
Yeah, Senator Thompson, I guess there's this philosophical discussion here about the goal of the program. We have literally the authors of the program, minus one former Senator Saltzman here, and some would argue the program was built to help seed and grow certain kind of small businesses. You just articulated as good as you can that the goal was to produce
might be able to do better.
High-wage jobs. Those aren't necessarily the same. I think we're close. I think we're close, and I think this is helpful, and I just appreciate the fact that we didn't have two of these guys here the other day to help further the discussion. So Senator Tomasoni moves.
Oh, no, I don't want to move it. It's Lily's bill, so let him move it.
You're Senator Torres-Ray. Right?
Mr. Chair and Senator Lilly, in our last committee hearing, I think you extended an invitation to me to do an amendment to your bill. I understood that. So I would like to amend your bill to put a provision to capture some information from the people who are recipients of this. And you know, I was looking into this handout that we got, which is, I think, great, and it points to the significance of this investment and how, you know, in a short period of time, we've really grown businesses, and I would like to know who these individuals are. So I would like to suggest that we collect more information about these individuals and these businesses, and I would like to offer an oral amendment to incorporate the words gender and ethnicity on line 28, page 4, section 3. So it will read on page 4, again, line 28, the name, mailing address, phone number, contact person's name, comma, gender and ethnicity, and industry type, and on. So we will be collecting, along with name and this other information, gender and ethnicity. That's my amendment.
Senator Torres-Ray, let me just check Senator Council if she was able to capture that.
Yes, Mr. Chair and members. On page 4, line 4.28, after contact person's name, insert gender and ethnicity. And I think Senator Torres-Ray read it correctly. The name, mailing address, phone number, contact person's name, gender and ethnicity, and industry type would be the way the sentence would read.
I think this is for a different purpose. This is for publishing.
Mr. Chair, members, this is the information that's collected currently on the application submitted to the commissioner and regarding data privacy issues. Mr. Chair, members, there's also within this, the ANGEL program, a subdivision that doesn't appear in this bill or any other bills that we've looked at. It's on a report to the legislature. And Senator Torres-Ray, I can, you know, this is going to be heard again, I think, in taxes. And you might want to, we could also try to collect some of this information in this annual report that goes to the legislature. So there may be some other places that, you know, can be collected, but this is okay too. I just think there's also this report to legislature that maybe when it's heard in the other committees, we could try to get it inserted in there as well.
You're not put it here. Here's the report to the legislature.
Senator Torres-Ray, and I see Mr. Nelson wants to
thank you,
in too.
Mr. Chairman, and thank you to the staff for this. You know, part of it is we cannot report to the legislature what is not being collected. So I hope, you know, you're able to help me kind of identify those pieces, because if we just don't collect that information, then it's impossible to report. So I think that by capturing this information in here, then we can provide the report.
And Mr. Chair, members, and I think this is this would have to be added to the application then. Right now, I'm sure it's not part of the application. So what we would need to instruct DEED to do is actually have this be part of the application. Right now, this is just addressing what on the application, what data is private or public. And that's what they're trying to change right now, what would be available as public data. So I think we can probably, you know, instruct the DEED to put this kind of information as a requirement and as part of the application process, and then also be part of the reporting requirement, what needs to be collected by DEED on an annual basis.
Senator
Thank
Lilly.
You.
Mr. Chair, Senator Torres-Ray, if I could ask for some, I don't know exactly how to suggest this, but because we don't have access to this section of the statutes in front of us, but statute 116J.8737 subdivision 9 does refer to the report to the legislature, and that is that it would seem to me that yes, we do want to collect this information, and I concur with that. I'm totally open to that. I am concerned that if we collect it in the place that we are referring to, that is published to the public, and I think that is more than the purpose that you were seeking. I think what you're really looking for is to collect the data so that we can make a determination if the funds, if the jobs, if the credits are getting to the place that we want them to and serving the purposes that we want to. And I'm concerned about the data privacy of doing it in the section of law statute that we have in front of us. So Mr. Chair, I don't know exactly how to do this. If we could promise to add this at another point or in taxes or how we could achieve this, but I would make my commitment that I would make sure that we get this this information into the collection of data that Senator Torres Rey is seeking.
Thank you for that, Senator Lilly. Just get Senator, or excuse me, Mr. Nelson on the record.
Mr. Chair,
earlier he was ready to talk to this amendment.
I think we've discussed this well, and I do agree with counsel and Senator Lilly that we do not want this in the data privacy part of the statute. Otherwise, we are perhaps revealing more about individuals and their companies than we wish to reveal, that an appropriate place would be in the section dealing with the report to the legislature.
Senator Torres Rey, I've heard a pretty strong commitment from the author, and I'm following up his earlier commitment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I will work with the staff to see if we can bring it to the floor and just put it in the proper place. So I withdraw my amendment right now, and I'll work.
And Senator, I think you'll be able to do that in the tax committee because that's where this bill will go next.
Okay.
And
okay.
So staff and Senator Rey and Senator Lilly will work on that. So Senator Lilly moves that Senate File 2290 be recommended to pass and sent to the tax committee. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion is adopted. Members, we're half an hour late, and I apologize for that. We've got a committee scheduled for tomorrow at 8:30 in room 112. We'll take up Senator Nelson's bill. Thanks for your patience tonight. Committee adjourned.